Welcome to the Visible Coaches podcast. I'm Angela Durant and you'll meet Anke Herman a little later. Between us, we have 30 years of business experience. We've started and grown our businesses from nothing but an idea, learning to play to our strengths as introverts in what often feels like an extrovert world. If you have ever felt any resistance to how others tell you you have to market yourself or bare your soul on social media just to get clients, then this podcast is for you. We know the unique challenges that introverted coaches face when it comes to selling their services. So, if you're ready to learn how to spot those golden opportunities right under your nose, clarify your message, nurture that market, and get more business coming your way, all without sacrificing your energy levels or well-being, then plug your AirPods in and let's go. So welcome to the Visible Coaches podcast with Angela and Anke. Today, we've got a very poignant and special podcast. Myself, Angela, I lost my husband. I didn't lose him. He didn't run away or anything. My husband died on Monday, the 22nd of April. After a long battle with cancer of over 14 years, but a short battle with pneumonia and blood clots over the last week. And I wanted to record this because I've noticed something hugely about state of mind in the middle of dealing with the aftermath of loss. And we both thought it would be incredibly helpful to share that with you, because whether it's loss and death as I'm experiencing, or whether it's something to do with business or an expectation, navigating that state of mind is the only job in town if you want to experience clarity and the ability to keep moving forward in a way that will be more sustainable and helpful. So we're going to open up that conversation. So join us and maybe make sure you might have a tissue and that you're not driving or operating heavy machinery in the process. So Anke, I wanted to suddenly record this. We'd got on the phone. Well, we got on our Zoom call and we were just talking about presence and state of mind. And I was sharing that I'd seen something really interesting over the last 4 days since I lost him. And the first thing that I had seen is that it was almost like my state of mind was like a slide ruler. And somewhere in the present moment was a balance. And you could go a little bit to the left in the past, like a couple of days, and you could go a little bit in the right, like the next couple of steps ahead of you, maybe the next week or two, maybe even the next kind of 3 weeks, maybe month at the most. But when I tried to imagine, or my mind zipped into the future, you know, how was my life going to turn out for the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years, potentially, without this huge presence of my husband in my life, I noticed massive anxiety hitting me, like massive anxiety. It's like I just could not imagine a future without him. I had no idea. And like I didn't even want to imagine being happy. And right on the opposite end of the scale, when I saw a picture, or as I opened the kitchen door and saw a can of Heinz tomato soup, because that's the only thing he could eat. Cancer drugs. I just burst into tears. And whenever I saw pictures of him in his most vibrant state, you know, in our past 10, whenever I thought about our past 22 years together, and that the fact that I'd known him 34 years, like all of my life. And I thought about those early years and the times that we just got together and how our love blossomed, etc. When I went that far back, the sense of loss was absolutely profound. There was a mixture of just, there was so much warmth in it, but the sense of loss was profound. And I started to notice something quite interesting about the mind's journey in navigating this. It's like the mind wants to try and settle on some level of certain feeling. And so there's a little bit of a darting backwards and forwards. Sometimes it's darting way into the future, and you're like, wee, that's the rumble strip, you know, like, don't go there yet. That's not the place to go. Sometimes it goes all the way into the past, and I can be just dissolved into tears for about 20 minutes. And then it kind of like the mind wants to bounce back into the present and go, come on, Angela. Because that's what my husband Paul would be. He said, you know, babe, I want you to miss me and all that, but you know, I don't want you to be unhappy. I don't want you to be unhappy, and certainly don't become like your mother and you know, and sort of like sit in a morose state, sort of just feeling grief all your bloody life, you know. So those words alone have kind of brought me back into a very interesting sense of now. And in the sense of now, there's always been just the next step to take. Like there's an action, there's a momentum, teeny little bit of momentum that comes in the next moment. There's something to do next. And it's almost obvious to me, but only if I can just allow this mind to go back and forward, but not too far. Just like see it, get conscious of when it's gone too far in one direction or the other, and allow it to just come back into the present moment with just a kind of just a little bit of kind of edge either side. Does that make sense?
It makes total sense. And I think it's such a gift to be able to be conscious, like, you know, not just feeling it, but kind of knowing that you're feeling it, right? That is, I think, the key to getting through anything and being able to process it in a way that isn't either kind of drowning in it and wallowing in it and kind of like getting lost in it, but it's also not shoving it under the carpet and like, let's just get on with it. So knowing that that anchor of the present moment, because the present moment, there's always this moment of peace, like right now, right here, for this one breath, I'm okay, you know. And I think the further you get away from that, either in the past, where, you know, where there's like regret and loss and grief and all the things. But what is that? It's just like you're looking back and you just wish you had more of that again, you know. So it's like your thoughts going that way, the further that goes, the worse you'll feel, you know. And in the future, you know, what's worry? And that's imagining the future in the worst possible way. There's only anxiety if you picture your future as like, oh my God, I'm gonna feel like I'm feeling now for the next 40 years. If that's the thought, you're gonna feel like shit. Like if you feel like there's all this stuff I want to do, then you'll feel different about it. Like, you know, that connection between thought and emotion is so strong, and it's also the thing, the key is to be able to observe it, because then you can allow yourself to go there, because you know you'll come back to the present moment, and you know, and then you can go that way. And so you can experience almost the whole depth of it without getting lost in it.
Yeah, and you're kind of completing the present moment in and of yourself. And that's a really interesting concept, because when I think of like pre-Monday, there were, when I just even think about a month ago or even 6 months ago, how I was as a person 6 months ago, there were little agendas in my mind. Things that I felt I needed to strive for, things that I thought that I had to have or had to do in order to be, have, do something else. What's really interesting is I have seen a very interesting ease of provision coming to me that I probably would never, I would only have ever given mental assent to without having this experience. So I'll put it in some context. Our new marketing assistant, Mary in Nigeria, sent me the most incredible email. She hasn't been with us that long, has she? She sent me the most incredible email. And she said, I pray God's provision goes before you even know you need it. And that really touched me. And here's what I noticed showing up. My sister, when we were sort of just navigating Paul going into hospital, and the first day was overwhelming. I had the dog to deal with. I had the school run. I was worried about leaving the dog for like 4 or 5 hours at a time, stuck in the crate to be at the hospital. And it felt really quite almost as if my mind had gone into some level of, I must keep it all together and do it all, etc. And on the Tuesday, my friend Rachel came, she messaged me and she said, I'm coming over with dinner. What do you want? And everything inside of me wanted to wait. No, don't trouble yourself. Don't come. It's all right. We've got it sorted. You know, we've got food in the house. And then something stopped me and just went, receive it. Receive it. Receive the help that people want to give you. Receive the effort that people want to make on your behalf. So she came down with dinner and suddenly I realized just how much having the presence of that person in the room was. My sister, I didn't ring till the next day. It popped into my mind in the moment. Angela, you haven't phoned your sister yet. And when I phoned her, she was in the car with her daughter. She's my stepsister. And her daughter was taking her to the airport to fly back to their place in Spain. And she said, if you'd have phoned a couple of hours later, I'd have been on a plane. She drove 4.5 hours from Norfolk to where I am in Cardiff. And she enabled me for the whole week. She stayed with the dog. She just was a presence in the house. And she enabled me to go and spend 7 hours at a time with Paul in the hospital and not worry about the dog. There is provision. There was provision there for me in the form of, I wanted to just kind of put quote unquote, and the women came, because that is what I've experienced. And I've always struggled with a lot of women's stuff. You know, I've had a lot of male clients. I've never found myself in just women's stuff, but, and the women came, and the women have come in floods. They've come with their messages. They have come with practical things. And they have enabled me to do what I need to do. And the money was there as well, because as soon as I lost Paul, my next door neighbor and my sister literally both said within 5 hours of each other, you need to apply for a widow's pension, which of course sounds really crazy when you're like, you know, in your early 50s. It just makes me feel like about 80 years old or something. And I didn't even think about these things. But straight away, when I applied, because Paul's older than me and my daughter's still in full-time education, I get this full amount. I don't think it was what it used to be, but I get this full amount, which pays for the funeral and pays to, you know, Paul had a car that I need to keep running. And suddenly I was faced with taking on about £600-700 of bills extra. You don't realize what you suddenly have to take on when there's a partnership that is shared and the shared, you know, payments and responsibilities, and you are suddenly taking it all on. My insurance went up. You know, I had to do my house insurance. That went up by about £70 or £80, because now I'm more vulnerable on my own, the algorithm says. And
that's
it was
ridiculous.
And there was, you know, the drop down menu where you suddenly have to choose widowed. It's you know, all of those things that come in the moment. And then the provision was 10 grand in that for me. It just, and I tell you what I learned, and I said it to our members of the Visible Club in the sales and strategy session. It's the only thing I've turned up to, because it's been really helpful actually to focus just that one step forward or on somebody else's life and business actually. And I'd said, you've got to listen and think, unless you're in the present moment, you're not going to have the capacity mentally to really actively listen for that next small voice, that next little bit of energy, that next thing that's actually telling you, do this. I think 6 months ago, if somebody had said to me, just, you know, go and apply for widow's pension, I'd have just gone, yeah, I must do that. and stuck it on the mental to-do list in my mind that would have got, you know, forgotten about or left or left or left or left, all those things that we just go, yeah, I must get to that, and we leave it. Well, I acted on it straight away. I acted on that impulse straight away because I had such a clear and present mind at the moment. And straight away, I get the maximum kind of amount coming to me, provision that gives me the time to ease into this and to organize things. I've seen that provision like over and over again, just like massive, massive provision in different ways. We have a perception of how that provision comes to us. So, you know, so Ella, yesterday, my daughter was going, Mum, we need to go and do something. We need to go and do a shop. You know, the essentials like crisps and chocolate, we just haven't got them. And in my heart of hearts, I was like, the last thing I felt like was normality. Just going into the shops and not buying the same things I would buy for Paul, I couldn't face it. I just wasn't there yet. It's like 4 days. My friend turns up yesterday evening and she said, I thought I'd do you a shop, just some bits and pieces. And I, again, you're just like, oh my goodness, that provision goes before you. Now, that provision was probably always going before me. It's not because I've just lost my husband that suddenly the provision tap has been turned on.
But you notice it more.
It's just that
thing, it opens that. I think you're more open to receiving it, you know, because when you are, like, at least, I don't know, like, I relate to that. It's like when I'm at my best, I'm like, yep, doing it, you know, there for everybody else. But when you're kind of like under the weather, it's like, I think that's when you even take notice of it, when you're even there to receive it. So I think it's one of those, it's perhaps the thing that makes a situation like that, it turns, you know, there is the flip side. There's always, I always say there's a gift underneath ever. There's a diamond underneath every shit pile. You can't see it usually when you're in the middle of it, you know, but this feels to me like the diamond that is in a shit pile like that. It's like that receiving and notice how many people are there for you and being open to just like, oh, thank you, you know, rather than, oh no, not necessary. Yeah. You know, I think that is massive.
Oh, totally. And before Monday, I would have dismissed so much of that. And that's been an interesting realization that was, you know, in different forms was always there for me to lean on, lean into and ask. Certainly at this point when people go, just, I don't know what to say, but please, if you need anything, please just ask. And sometimes I'm like saying, well, I don't actually know what I need now. But before I would have just gone, well, I won't lean on you. I just, you know, that's just platitudes. Everybody says that and nobody means it. But actually, I realized that, you know, there's this twofold thing. Sometimes the ones that are really close to you just come and get moved and bring something or do something. And then there's a time for me to reach out to people and say, I'd like to have a coffee, I'd like to meet, I'd like some help, could you? And opening the door of blessing to them, that when they help you, they receive something in that giving and you receive something in that receiving, rather than just shutting the door and trying to be so fiercely independent about everything, to prove
trauma response, right?
Yeah. Because resilience, I think resilience is, I almost think now resilience is done in pairs. Certainly not on your own. I think we've got the wrong concept of resilience, you know. I think resilience is not about being resilient in and of yourself on your own.
Oh no. So, and I think that piece of, you know, what can I do to help? It's like, I think at the heart of, like, at the very moment, you know, when it hits you, that's kind of not really, I mean, obviously, if people knew what they could do for you, they'd probably do it, right? So this usually would come from people who aren't sort of that close. They want to help, but they don't know how, you know, and you probably won't be able to take them up on this. because it's the mental load of now I have to think of something that you can do to feel better to help me, you know. And like when you're in the thick of it, you're not going to have headspace for that, you know.
No.
But it also doesn't mean to discard it or to assume it's not genuine, you know.
No.
And I think when you do have the headspace, well, will you allow yourself to take him up on that, you know, and ask for stuff?
Yeah. It's been, when I sit in the kind of quietness, the one thing I've really, really realized is how important relationships actually are. Building relationships, maintaining relationships, business is about relationships. And what we do many, many times is we put up these boundary walls of brilliance almost, you know, and find, you know, we'll get our copywriting and our message so perfect that people will just say yes to us with a click. I mean, it's like we're meant to be in relationship with each other. And I've never seen that more than right now. About the fostering, the bringing. And that doesn't necessarily mean it's very easy. I mean, I had a friend come round and she did not know what to say to me at all. And because she's dealing with her own stuff, there was that sense of almost talking at me. And there was a big sense that I almost had to breathe and just let her talk at me because she didn't know how to handle it herself. And, you know, that kind of sense of like, well, you know, when people come say, well, you've got to be grateful, haven't you? And I'm like, oh, no, I haven't actually got to be anything. I am grateful. But again, look, and I think I listened to somebody, I think it was Jordan Peterson on, I just caught like a reel of his. And he said, he said, when people aren't listening to you, he said, just listen very, very carefully. He said, because they will reveal what's going on when they're not listening to you. And I was like, oh, that's so true. You know, like, so when we feel that we're not being listened to or heard, you know, by another person or they're talking over us, I've done that too with people. It was that bit. It's like, you just sit there and pay attention, because everything that's actually going on behind the scenes for that person who's not listening to you will start to reveal itself. And I was like, oh, that's very, very true right now. Who can be with you and who can't be with you right now?
And that, I think that is like an observation where I think it's every time something happens, you know, I've had people talk about that when they had like a cancer diagnosis, when they first get diagnosed, right? When there's something happened or there's a situation like this where people are out of their depth. Like a lot of people don't know how to handle it, like how to be with somebody else, you know? And most of the time people will say, Jesus, people that I didn't really think much of have come, you know, forward and been the biggest support. And sometimes like people you thought were really close friends, really close to you, like literally don't show up at all because they don't know how. They don't know how to be with you in that situation. And, you know, they don't know what to say, so they don't say anything, you know, it's that, or say something stupid or, you know, whatever stupid. I mean, whatever makes sense to them that might not be helpful to you in the moment. But I think it's always interesting to see.
It's because they can't
can
be with themselves.
It. You know,
yeah, it's because they can't be. It's because they can't be with themselves. If you can't be with yourself, if you haven't sorted that out, you know, at least you can be with somebody else with not having to make somebody else's experience better so that you can feel better about yourself and not being able to handle that experience. I'd learned that. I didn't learn that with my mother's death. I really tried to control that experience. Because I was in a lot of, you know, emotional pain, and it was very difficult when my mum died in 2017, and she'd had a long illness. But I learned my lesson with that, and I learned my lesson with Paul. And I think, particularly in the final months, it was very, very hard to witness somebody going through a lot of suffering, and a lot of mental suffering, and a lot of physical suffering. But I also knew this time round that I could not fix that suffering mentally or physically, and it wasn't my job to. And the most important thing that I could do was to simply be myself, be with that suffering without trying to placate it, take it away, fix it. And I think what's really interesting with coaches, coaching, etc., I think that that ability to sit with somebody and let them go through what they're going through without coming in and fixing it, unless advice is asked for, is incredibly, I think it's actually probably the hardest boundary of when to actually step in and when not to step in. I think we don't understand that until we've had enough experience of it working one way or another at all.
And I think the natural sort of the tendency, you know, when you sort of grow up, it's like, oh, you know, like this idea of fixing it. And I think it's actually even worse for helper souls, you know, people who really derive most of their satisfaction from helping other people. Because you know how often do we ask people, like, what is it that you most love to do? And people, I just love to help people, right? So people like that, I think, struggle more with that, you know, to step back, to let the other person go through whatever they're going through without you trying to intervene and take it all away for them. I think that, but at the end of the day, everybody lives their own experience. You know, can you really fix anybody anyway?
No. Can you actually inspire somebody? I think they choose to be inspired. Can you influence anybody? No, they choose to be influenced. And the biggest capacity is, can you impact somebody? People say they always want to make an impact. I want to make an impact on people. I want to make an impact in the world. Like, well, actually, the only way that that is even possible is you're probably going to be the last person to realize you've made an impact unless somebody tells you.
And most of the time you won't know.
No. And the only way to actually realize whether and how you've been impacted is to think of your own experience of who has actually impacted you. So when I put the post out on Facebook, and I managed to hack into my husband's Facebook account, shush, don't tell Mark Zuckerberg. But, you know, my husband used to think it was really cool, uncool to be friends with your wife, you know, on Facebook. And he wasn't even on Facebook for many, many years, but he wanted to get back on to get his studio photos. He was an eminent music producer. And I managed to get in and managed to put a message on his profile, and the outpouring of all of the bands that he'd worked with over the years in the studio and how much creativity he'd poured into other people and enhanced their creativity with his own, and how many times, to be quite honest, he replaced their bad playing and never ever told them, so they always thought it was theirs. And the outpouring when people said the experience they'd had and who he was as a person, my husband Paul lived himself, if that makes sense. He absolutely lived himself. There was nothing in him that tried to be like anybody else, that aspired to be like anybody else. I've never known anybody like that. He was so comfortable in his own skin, in who he was, and he was so good at what he did that he never needed to pretend. Never needed to pretend. And he didn't even need to take the credit. Something he would always say to me when I would do something around the house and I go, look what I've just done. And he said, yeah, right. Well, you know, I've done the hoovering, the floor, the this, that, the other. I just didn't need a pat on the back for it. And to me, like, real maturity is that ability to get the job done, do it, you know, better than average, really, because he was the kind of person who could almost strive for perfection and aim pretty close to it, because he was good at what he did and he practiced what he did well. And then he poured that creativity into other people. Really poured it, mentored them, told them stories, told them how to improve things, little tricks here, little tricks there. But what was interesting to me, I think, when you said about the helper community, is that my husband did something that I think was very important, and I've only just seen it, which is why I'm sharing it. And I didn't do it, which is why it hurt me so much. He helped others and he expressed his creativity himself. He made his own music, he created music. He didn't just pour everything into everybody else at the expense of himself. He created his own thing and he created stuff for other people. When I was in a space where I didn't really understand that, I spent years, perhaps because I'm a female, pouring everything into everybody else and then playing the martyr that that it didn't matter, you know, that my time was over. I mean, how ridiculous. But it was that because I was so unaware and unable to tap into my own creativity at the time, typical mother, typical stuff, too much going on, that you brush it under the carpet. But he had it right. It wasn't a case of either or. It wasn't a case of pouring yourself into other people to help them. And so you only get your sense of satisfaction from helping others. He got his sense of satisfaction from being creative in and of its own right too. And that, I think I want to, that's something I really want to share here, because that makes you a complete human when you are both creative for the sake of creativity. And people don't want to be creative for the sake of creativity. They want to have an outcome. Well, there was always an outcome for my husband. The outcome was a fantastically produced piece of music. But it wasn't either at the expense of just helping people, like just being an artist and that's it. I'm not, you know, it's all about me. And it wasn't just about everybody else at the expense of his own creativity. And therefore he was a really complete person in and of himself. So he never had to steal the limelight from somebody else. He never did.
And I think that's, you always find like people who are exceptional at what they do don't need to rub it in or be like arrogant about it. You know, you'll see it in any field, right? You know, somebody who is really at the top of their game, they share, they mentor, they support others because they've got this cup that's overflowing. You know, they don't need to like, ooh, you know, if I tell you this trick, then you'll be better than me. And I won't, you know, like, don't have any of that going on.
Nope.
You know, and I think there's so much to learn from that. I think this piece of not ignoring your own outlet, you know, I think any business owner, we've had this in a CAO session, like, I think it's come up a few times, you know, that, like, it's hard to take, like, it comes up usually in the context of taking time off, right? Because there's always more to do. There's always, oh, I should be. There's almost like that guilt factor when you're not working, when you're not working on the business and doing this and doing the other thing. So I think it's one of those beautiful lessons to remember, like, you are not slowing yourself down when you make space to do your own thing and to tinker and to patter and to do stuff that you just simply enjoy, you know, whatever your outlet is. But I think making time for that actually speeds you up, because, you know, like pushing harder doesn't make you go faster. But I think it's such an easy trap to fall into, because when you have a job, your job description gives you the framework. They kick you out of the office, like, you can't stay there till midnight, right? But if it's your business, it's so tempting to get sucked into that. Like, and I think you have the gift of having had that huge example right in your house, yeah. You know? Yeah. So I shall watch to make sure you
don't forget. He knew. Well, he knew how to relax as well. And he used to say to me, babe, you just don't know how to stop. Because my mind was like that. And he'd work really hard. Like, he'd get a project in, or he'd do a project with a band, and he'd work like solidly for, you know, about 3 weeks to create and complete this project. And then he'd, when he'd finished it, he'd stop. Then he'd have a break. And then something else. And, you know, and I do think that because he loved what he did, there was that ability to have almost like an enormous momentum energy behind what he did. So I think really the thing that I notice is it's not that in business there's things that I don't want to do and you have to do certain things. It's that to keep coming back to that listening, to that place of quiet listening, that you are actually doing the thing that you need to be doing, not because everybody else has got a trend going on. And I'll give you a quick example here. We had the sales and strategy session yesterday, and two of our members are working in collaboration with each other and very, very successfully. And there was this almost this question, well, what do we do for these clients afterwards? Should we create a membership? Should we actually create something together and get these people in it, etc.? And I could just, you know, I could just stop and I was like, oh, this is so interesting. The need to force something, to get something in place, is so massive. And I went, well, why this? Why the membership? Why the mentorship? Why this? And there wasn't really an answer, except that if you realize it's like, well, everybody's looking at in the marketplace at like what everybody else is doing. And as my husband used to call them, sheeple, if we're not careful, we become sheeple. We start to go, well, I must have to do that. I must have to do it this way. And I just stopped and I went, hang on a minute. You're working incredibly well collaboratively together. Why the need to change that? And actually, you at the stage of building your business and your brand, there's a lot more to do around that rather than jump ship. Because if you have to start marketing something different as well as your own business, that's going to be a harder job for you to do. And this permission, it was almost like, I don't think anybody expected me to come out with this don't do it bit. Don't put, you know, don't try and sort of feed something else into the mix, but actually just double down and get better at the marketing of what you've already got. You see, because that means we've got to stop. That means we've actually got to think differently. That means we've actually got to get creative in a different way, and sometimes go off piste and not follow what everybody else is saying or doing, but look at what is actually right for us in the next stage in our life, in our business, which is, that's the real reason why I wanted to even say this about talking about present mind and about active listening and about listening for those small pieces of wisdom that if you act on them, they bring the provision in for you before you really even realize you need it. It's right there. And it's like almost like a hand grab away. But you've got to not try and be forcing yourself like 40 miles down the road to get
jumping ahead. Because yeah. I think for me, what it feels like, we've talked about this a million times, about the tiny steps, right? And I think problems will, I always say, you know, I don't know how many people say, like, oh, you need t-shirts and that. Like, when it feels hard, you're skipping steps.
Yeah.
Like, people try and jump ahead. So in this case, it's like, oh, we jump ahead, assuming, making up the needs of these people. Like, yeah. You try and create a solution without even knowing what the problem is, right? So that's the first problem. The collaboration piece, we've talked about this a million times, where I'm always saying, like, don't do this kind of mix thing. It makes things hard. Like, it messes things up. And I think I always call it fear-based collaboration. When you kind of feel safer with the other person there, you know, it's like, collaborate, yes, and be sure you know where you're coming from, and see how that always kind of gets up back into that, you know, and to try and jump ahead. Because if you are the close, and I think that comes back to what we were talking about before, it's like there's the past, there's the present moment, there's the future. The closer you stay in this present moment, the smaller the next step will be, you know, because it's literally that, you know, what Jamie Smart used to say, like this, you can only, like, if you imagine driving down a road at night in the fog, you have your headlights, you can only see, you know, 5 meters in front of you, and that's all you need to make the whole journey. So those next, that very next step, and I think the more you are in the here and now, the next step won't be this big, massive project. It will be that next tiny step that takes you in the right direction. And I think the more you can kind of remember and remind yourself to come back to that space, you know, the more you can, you know, experience all of life without getting lost in the bullshit.
Thank you for listening. We'll be back soon. Take care.
Take care. Thanks for tuning in to the Visible Coaches podcast. If you've ever felt the pressure to market yourself in ways that don't align with your true nature, this podcast is your sanctuary. If you've enjoyed what you've heard so far, make sure to subscribe to the Visible Coaches podcast on your favorite platform. And we would really be grateful if you could leave us a review. Your feedback means the world to us, and it helps us reach more introverted coaches like you. Visit thevisiblecoachespodcast.com now. That's thevisiblecoachespodcast.com. Let's continue to embrace our introverted strength, create meaningful connections, and make waves in the coaching world. Until next time.